This is a tape with Mr. Frank Oslos, a Belgian man who lives at 116 Thrush Street in Green Bay. He was a farmer in the New Franken area for 55 years. On the tape, he relates experiences dealing with brickmaking, education, farming, fishing, funerals, and especially about the process of making Hugard beer. The interview took place on February 26, 1976. The interviewer is Leah Krieger.
My grandfather, born in 1839 at Hoegaarden, Belgium, came to America at the age of 17 and was a full-fledged brewmaster, having worked around the brewery since his boyhood. The beer made was called Hoegaard beer because it is supposed to be made only in that town by a secret formula. It was a raw beer, aged very little and supposed to be used within 2 weeks. As far as I can remember, it was made of sprouted barley, with the sprouts carefully removed, boiled water, a yeast culture, and to give it just the right degree of dark color, a certain amount of burnt bread crusts, which had been removed from loaves of outdoor oven-baked bread, which I believe was purposely burnt to ensure thorough baking, and to have the crusts for the beer. I remember my mother saying that at that time, making beer and baking bread were two regular chores. Of course, it should also be mentioned he did not drink that beer all himself. We were making bricks at that time, which was all hard hand work. And between the brick makers and the brick buyers and visitors, the beer did not have a chance to spoil. This went on for about 30 years till he died in 1906.
Okay, can I ask you a few questions then about the beer?
Sure.
I wanted to know if the crust, the burnt crust, gave any taste to the beer, any burnt taste to the beer.
I imagine they did. Well, you see, I didn't drink it. I was 2 years old when he died, you see. But I think people liked beer that had a little dark color at that time. Now they want pale beer, eh? But at that time it was dark beer. It looked better.
Yeah. When do you think that changed from liking dark beer to the light beer?
Well, you see, around Easter they want Bock beer. You ever hear of Bock beer?
No, what's that?
Bock beer is a beer that's a darker, heavier flavor. They drink it at Easter. Now, I don't know why, but it's...
Is this a Belgian custom?
No. The Bock beer is made by brewers, you know.
Oh,
Bock
I don't think
beer.
I've ever had it.
No. Well, I would think that maybe that's the idea of having that crust, those dark crusts in there, to darken the beer, make it look more body, I suppose.
How was it that your grandfather came to know the secret?
Well, he was from Hoegaarden. He was born in Hoegaarden, and he worked around the brewery, I think, from the time he was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
So
he just kind of picked it up, or did someone tell him?
Oh, no, he worked in the brewery, so he knew the secret.
Oh.
Right after World War II, there's a fellow by the name of Mr. Allard. He was an art teacher, an art teacher, I'd say. He came to this country and wanted to get students to go to Belgium to study art. And I told him, well, my folks came from Belgium. They were from Hoegaarden, where they make Hoegaard beer, I said. And he made it out here, made Hoegaard beer out here. And he said, oh, no, he says, Hoegaard beer is only made in Belgium, he said, in Hoegaard. Nobody else knows the secret. I said, well, he had the secret in his head when he came over, so he made it here. So then he was all stunned and surprised. Well, for heaven's sake, they say there's only one. That's the only place in the world where they make it, he said. And it can't be exported because, you see, they put it in kegs and they tap the kegs and drink it there. And it has to be... It's a raw beer, so it ain't... It's made of the boiled with boiled water and the ingredients, you see. But then after they don't reboil it after it's re-sterilize it, as you might say. So that's this. All the strength stays in. If you ever had any information about making moonshine, you know. I never made any either. But you see, they have their stuff in a container, and it ferments, and then they boil it. I mean, they boil it with that condensers, and the first steam that comes off, that's alcohol, mm-hmm. or mostly alcohol. And then at a certain time, when alcohol is boiled off, they shut it off then, because you'd have that water going in, you see. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's the secret of having this beer not boiled. All the alcohol is in. It was strong beer.
Have you ever tasted it after it's spoiled? What happens to it when it spoils? How is it different?
Well, I was 2 years old when he quit making it. My mother used to make it too, but she never made it to any extent, you know.
Oh.
The idea of boiling it is to preserve it, you know, so it keeps better. But you see, they had didn't care to keep it. You see, it was made to drink. You see.
So he passed the recipe on to your mother, but she never kept it.
Well, my mother could make it too. You see, my mother could have made it too, but we didn't pay too much attention. You had those cans to make beer then, you know. So, but I remember my mother making it, but.
Do you think the recipe's around anymore, any place?
Oh, no, because my mother was the only one that knew how to make it.
She never wrote it down or anything?
No.
that was about the secret,
well, the timing, that I don't know anything, you see, the timing.
Right.
But.
Yeah, when was it, about what year did your mother quit making it? Just to get an idea of when it.
Well, my mother didn't want to... us to get into making beer. She didn't want us to be soaked, she said. So, but there were other ways of getting beer after, see, but at that time, you see, we were kids, and you don't have to know how.
Does the name Hugard mean anything besides the city? I mean, does it have a translation in any way?
Well, wait, do you ever see a map of Belgium? You can shut that off. I'll show you a map of Belgium. I'll show you where it is, you see.
Okay. You mentioned the brick makers drinking the beer before. What about the different colors and different kinds of bricks around
here? It was one color. It was a made out of clay from our farm, and then the sand from Dykesville. Beach sand, I guess it was, or no, just north of Dykesville there, or right in Dykesville, there are sand piles there.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been beach sand from way, way years ago, you see. And, that must have been very long ago, because those piles of sand, they erode, you know, and the natives there, Mr. Lancel told me already that on his farm there, there's a skeleton of an Indian head, you know, showing. So he picked it up and he took it home and put it by the clock. But his wife got so worked up with that she made him throw it away, she says. So.
Oh, I've seen two different colors of bricks on some houses. What?
But the bricks that were used, that we made, are just all the same color. The same color, and it's a porous brick, but it's a hard brick. And there are houses in the town of Eaton, there are houses around Tonnette, Dykesville, and I'd say for 20 miles around they use our bricks to make houses, because at that time that was about the only bricks that there were. But afterwards, different ones, like around the Green Bay and the pier here, they made bricks too. But ours were, I'd say, a different brick.
Did you make the light or the dark colored ones?
It was they were all the same color. It was a pinkish brick, reddish brick.
there, I've seen some light ones. What?
Well, if you'd go around Champion there and you see those houses, those are bricks from our place. The old houses.
Oh.
The old houses.
How were these bricks made and when did you make them? Were you a brickmaker yourself?
Oh, no, I was 3 years old when my father died, and then
they
stopped it. Huh?
Did he make bricks?
Yes, well, he made bricks after my he made bricks, yes, but after my father got killed when I was 3.5 years old, blasting stumps, you see. Stump hit him on the side of the head, and that was the end of it.
Hmm. Had he been a farmer in addition to making bricks?
Oh, yes, we were farming.
Then did you sell these bricks personally from your own home to neighbors?
Yes, sure. When a wagon was coming down the road, somebody's coming for bricks again. Get a pitcher of beer, and then they'll come in, you know, they tell what they want, then go to the brickyard and load up the bricks, then maybe come in, settle up or so, drink a few beers yet, they're ready to go home then.
What did bricks sell for at that time?
I think it was about $5 a thousand, $5-6 a thousand for the good ones.
What time of year did he do that when he could have time from farming to make make bricks?
I think it was mostly in spring and early summer and so on that they made the bricks. Mm-hmm. But I really don't know. But you see, after they were made, they had to be dried. Mm-hmm. They were put in forms. You know, just a form of a brick, and there were about eight bricks, I guess, in a mold. See there, they put that clay and sand in the mold, and they had to bang it here, bang it there, this way and that way.
To condense it.
That was all handwork, you see.
Yeah.
It was in a mold about so long.
How long is that, so that we can get it on the tape?
Huh?
We have to say how long it is so that the tape.
Well, about four length of four bricks, you see, and the width. I think there was about three widths.
So maybe a yard by a foot or so.
Yeah, it was about maybe three bricks. What? About 30 inches. 30 inches by 18, about, and they'd have to bang it one way, bang it the other, jar it one way, jar it the other, to fill the corners, you see? And then rake it off, you see? Mm-hmm. With a raker, they'd rake it off, and that was the back side of the brick. The inner brick, you know, there's always a hollow space in the center here, you know, for an anchor, you see? But that was down, you see? There was a little deal in there down. So they'd rake off the top, and then it hit like that, and it was molded then. Then they'd turn it around on on wood lats. I mean, it was a piece of just like a little lats nailed together, you see? Mm-hmm. And the lats were, I'd say, just the length of those bricks. And they'd put those strips of lats on there. Then they'd turn it over and pull your form up. And the bricks were there. Then they'd dry to some extent. Then they'd pile them all up. And I remember it looked like a house, you know, the piles of bricks, you know, bigger than a house. Then I think they had to be coated on the outside with clay too to seal them. And there were some deals. Every so far, there was a deal, a little arch, to stick wood in there to burn the bricks.
Oh, you had to fire the bricks.
They had to be fired. And I remember it was deals looked about like this, you see.
Oh, they were like a little
like
shed
a little
something.
Arch, you see.
They made out of stone or what?
Well, in the bricks, among the bricks, you see. They'd pile the bricks in such a way as to have
pile the bricks. I see.
As to leave a hole in there, you see, and that was they'd shove the wood in there and burn that everyone, and that had to burn night and day for so long then to heat it up and to burned the bricks.
So they were fired in the open air. They weren't in a little kiln.
No, they were. Yes, they were outside, but they were. The pile was sealed, you see,
yeah.
And then that had to be knocked off later on. Huh.
Did any of your neighbors do that, or were you the only family?
No, we had a crew, but I don't know how many men there were. I couldn't tell how many men there were,
yeah.
But there were neighbors, you might say, that
like
young,
hired
help,
kids.
Hired help, yeah.
Huh,
yeah.
That's really interesting.
But then there were sheds, you know, I remember there must have been an acre of sheds, just more like mink sheds nowadays, you know, little mink shed, but a little, they were about man height, you know, and then a little roof on top, and there were shelves and shelves, and that was to store the bricks to dry up as they were being made, you know.
Mm-hmm. Gee, and did quite a bit of the money for your family come from that?
That I don't know. Well, you see, in those days, if they made $100, that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But nowadays, wasn't $100 enough to go to shopping? Yeah. But
really. I'd like you to also tell a little bit about sturgeon fishing. Maybe you can start out with that, and then we can go on from there, and I can ask questions.
Well. As far as fishing is concerned, I remember my grandmother telling how her brother, John Francis Vincent, who lived at what is now Edgewater Beach, was doing fishing and farming. He would haul in his nets in late Thursday afternoon or evening. I think some were seines. A seine is something that you go out in the water with, you know, and round up the fish and then bring them to shore, you see. And when there were sturgeons in them, my grandmother used to say they were man size. Some were man size, you know, as big as a man. And for the sturgeon, they'd get a cent a pound.
Yes.
That was 125-pound sturgeon. Well, you'd get $1.25, and boy, that was a lot of money. In those days, they worked for a few cents a day, you know, so. It was big money. Then after the next morning, maybe 4 o'clock in the morning, they had to hitch the horses and get them on the wagon and haul them to Green Bay before it would get warm, and at the same time, so that the people that wanted fish could get them and I suppose clean them out and in those days they didn't have refrigeration. So they had to have it fresh they'd haul them to the hotels and I think the meat markets or the mm-hmm. fish markets or whatever it was.
Was that in Green Bay that they'd haul them to?
Well, they were at Edgewater Beach. That ain't so far from Green Bay here. And they had their, I suppose they knew where they could haul them.
Yeah. So were any of them sold to processing plants or just to people, regular people?
Well, there were hotels, but
yeah. Oh, and they would use them for the restaurants, or?
Well, they didn't talk of restaurants in those days. They talk of hotels, you see,
yeah.
Hotels and boarding houses and so on.
See,
they'd come to in those days. They'd come to Green Bay with a load of potatoes and just peddle them. Whoever wanted potatoes up one street and down the other, and maybe a hotel would buy a few bags.
Did you ever do that when you were young, peddling things in Green Bay?
Well, we were further out.
Oh, so
we were. We lived in New Franken, you see, and at that time, you know, there were those produce houses would take care of those things. Then there were a couple of families here, the Bormans and the Everards, you know, they were gardeners, you know. They had more of a chance than other people would, you know.
These nets called seines, did the people make their own nets?
That I don't know, but I remember she used to say a seine, you said, and we didn't know what a seine was, but a seine is a long net. You go in the water, you go out in the water with it, and some of it floats, there are wooden floats that hold it up, and there are lid sinkers that hold the scrape on the bottom, and you bring it in. I've seen them do it already.
Oh, they still use that?
They just go around. One goes out with a boat, you know, and one holds the other end, you see, and they go out and just bring it in, you know, and pull it in, pull it in, pull it in, and it sort of makes a pocket then, you
see.
They pull, I suppose, on the bottom ones, you know, and the top ones are floating. And we watched them already, you know, and we were along the bay shore there, coming home from Green Bay, maybe on the bay shore, and once in a while a fish would jump over the... Get away, yeah.
What but, other kinds of fish besides sturgeons did they catch?
Oh, it was a fish that they called, in French, they call them the dory. It was a... It was a more like a pike, I guess that's what they call it, dory. But it's more of a on the order of perch, I guess. A pike is more on the order of a perch, but it's a larger fish. And grandma liked. She respected the pike because that was a good fish. It didn't. She never talked so much of perch. It was the pike that they'd catch at that time, I think.
See. So it was mostly sturgeon and this pike.
Sturgeon and pike. Net. That's the one she mentioned the most. She mentioned, but I think later on, then well, we had herring and so on in there. But they might have had herring too. But I guess a herring, if it's caught in the net right away, it didn't.
I remember you told me once before about the sturgeons would stay alive.
Well, yes, on the beach, they must have been a hardy fish, the sturgeon, because the next morning they were still wiggling on the sand there after being on the dry sand all night.
I wonder why that was. What time of year was it that they would fish?
Well, that I don't know. It's... Her brother used to catch those fish, you know, but I don't know if there was a certain time they'd run. But they were common in Sturgeon Bay, you see, was in part of Green Bay, and there, well, Sturgeon Bay, so there must have been plentiful all the bay. It's the pollution, the water, the paper mills and so on, I suppose, that, you know, and then the dam at De Pere, you see, they've got to go up a river to spawn. Or out in different water, you see, or so, to spawn in clean water, I suppose. And then when they get to the dam at De Pere, well, even now the fish go out of the bay here, they go up to the dam at De Pere and they can't go any further, you see.
Did you ever hear us talk of ice fishing?
Oh, ice fishing, yes, on the bay, yeah. Well, see, when we were younger, we'd go ice fishing on the bay on Green Bay there, you see, off of Dykesville, Brussels, and around there. But we had to go quite a ways because there was pollution in the water, they'd say. And then, too, we'd catch herring. Some would catch a lot, some would catch a few. We usually caught a few there. And once in a while, we'd be a little lucky and get a mess of them, but it was more for the fun of it than anything else.
So did you fish, ice fish, when you were young on the farm?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, we'd go in wintertime, you see, on the ice. Yeah, sure, we'd go.
Did you spend more than one day out there? Like, did you have a little shanty and you'd stay overnight?
No, we never had shanty. We'd just fish out in the open, make a hole, you know, or find a hole and fish from that. And the herring come right up under the ice, you see, they run right under the ice. So you just fish just a little ways below the ice, and the herring would come and grab your hook, you know, and yank them out, take the barb off the hook, you know, just to leave the straight hook, you know. So you'd catch they'd bite, grab them, pull them out, and put them on the ice, and they let go, you know, and drop back in, ready for the next one, keep on like that, if they'd bite.
How did you get from the farm to the bay? Did you go by sleigh?
Oh, with a car.
Oh, with a car. This
well,
was
yes.
When
we were, by the time we were young, you know, we'd go with a car. And sometimes with the horse, too. With a horse and sleigh, you see.
Yeah, that's fun.
Just horse and a bobsled, you know, and go out like that.
Did you keep the fish that you caught, the herring, or did you sell those?
Oh, no, we never sold them, gave them away or ate them ourselves,
yeah.
You know.
What sort of things were made with the herring? What sort of Belgian dishes or...
Oh, we didn't make any Belgian dish. We'd fry them or we'd pickle them or so.
I see. Do you remember anything that your grandmother made with the sturgeon and the pike?
Oh, the sturgeon, I don't know if we ever had sturgeon, because the sturgeon, I suppose that was too big of a fish, you see. That was used to... But that was when my grandmother's brother would catch sturgeon. That was way before my time. You see, that must have been 100 years ago.
I thought maybe she told you about it or something.
No, she said the old sturgeon was good fish and no bones in. No, I don't know.
Oh, so she must have cooked it sometime.
Huh?
In order to know that, she must have.
Oh yes, well I suppose they did have some.
Yeah.
You know, there might have been some smaller ones in there. You know, that weren't so saleable. You know, or maybe against. Well, I don't know if there were laws against taking the small ones. Nowadays, they have to be 45 inches, eh? But that time, maybe they took everything. You see.
Did she ever say what she did with the insides, or if she ever made oil?
No.
I see.
I suppose the eggs, they threw them away, you see.
Yeah, probably.
And nowadays, you buy a little bit of it, and a spoonful of it, and costs a fortune.
Right. Did people who fished like this with the seines, did they farm at the same time, or were these
done differently? Oh, yes. Nobody lived just from fishing.
I thought maybe they had. Okay, let me see if I...
See, my grandfather, he was a Flemish, but he could talk 9 languages, and he could read 7, you see. When the people from town of Eton or so, you know, that was south of our southern part, way south of our place there, when they'd come for bricks, he'd talk Polish with them. When the Bohemians came, he'd talk Bohemian. When they were Germans, well, he'd talk German. When they were French, well, he'd talk French with them. If they came from Bay Settlement, you see, Bay Settlement was French, you see.
Mm-hmm.
He'd talk French with them. And if it was Walloon, well, he'd talk Walloon. If it was Flemish, he'd talk Flemish. If it was English, he'd talk English, see.
How did he learn all that?
Well, I'll tell you, if you know 2 or 3 languages, you can always learn a 4th one easier than if you learn it. You see, German and Flemish, Hollander, and I think to some extent Polish, they mesh together. And French, and Walloon, and Spanish, that's almost... Well, when you learn one, when you know one, it ain't hard to learn the other. See? And then two, what is it? There are 40,000 French words in the English language, ain't there?
Something like that, I think.
Yes, there's a lot of words that are exactly the same, and spelled exactly the same, and mean the same thing in French and in English. So you see, when you know a few languages, it ain't hard to learn another
one. Was this grandfather born in Belgium?
Came over at the age of 17.
Oh, he was the one who made Hugard
beer
also.
He's the one that came over at 17,
That's really interesting. So he was quite a businessman with all those languages.
Well, yes, he could get along. I mean, with the Germans, well, they call him a landsman, you know, and he was one of them, you see. And but he knew other languages too. There's only once that he was, they had great big wall maps, you know, great big deals of Brown County, with every farm on and every landowner on there. And he went out in the Polish section, town of Eton. There were Polish there in the town of Eton. And he had to go along because the fellow couldn't interpret for all those languages. So he was picked out as... They'd come and have him to go along to interpret. So the woman said, "But what if that map gets dirty then?" And so Grandpa asked him, "Fellow, she wants to know what should do if the map gets dirty." "Well, they're washable," he said. So Grandpa turns around to her and he says, "You can wash that like a dirty shirt," he said. But the woman tried to wash it, I suppose, wash it like a shirt too. And, you know, just like oil cloth, you know, that came loose. So it was for a while they didn't go back in the Polish section anymore to do any interpreting, then they said. They just laughed about it, you know. That. And those maps cost $5 a piece at that time, and that was about 1870. And we had one of those maps home till about 20 years ago, something like that. And the priest wanted to know, you know, something about Belgium, you know, the early settlers. So I gave it to him and I said, "You can copy what you want off it." But he kept the whole thing, so I never got it back. But at that time, $5 is the same thing as if you charge about $200 for a map nowadays. And maybe the thing would still be worth maybe $200 now.
Yeah, if there were any around.
But it was a map, something like the book you have out there, you know, with all the but it was on that order, yes, but it was the only thing, it was a wall map, you know, all in one piece, you see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you also about your farm life, too, as you grew up.
Oh, we didn't have too much of a farm because, you see, we had 40 acres and 32 acres and 20 acres. 20 acres was woods. But the 32 acres, then when my father died, you see, there was too much land. We couldn't work all that. So we sold that and we just kept the 40 acres. So.
How old were the children when your father died?
Well, I was 3.5 years old. My brother was 2, and I had a sister. She wasn't born yet, you see.
Oh, so the children and then, were too young to take
over.
Yeah,
my grandfather, my grandfather on my mother's side helped us out, you know, worked the farm and skimped and so on. So my mother had it hard, very hard.
I'm going to turn.